Finance and Revenue Committee is open. It's CPA Day here, one of the biennial trend traditions here.
It's become annual, Mr. Chair.
It's become annual at the Revenue Committee, and it's a good
thing.
Thanks
for really ruining my business.
We have some business to take care of before we get to that. First, I do want to announce there's a work group that will be formed on Senate Bill 129, better known as Gain Share. The members who are interested in economic development, revenue, or this issue. And those members are Representatives Gallegos and Davis and Senators Hansel, Devlin, and Steiner Hayward. And notices will be coming to your offices, and we will start hearings on that bill on the week of March 16th. You'll be getting that. Second, we have an LC that we would like to introduce as a committee bill. Paul, anything you want to say on this LC?
Mr. Chair, we have continued to work on some of the options that have been discussed in committee around the base and how to calculate that base and how to address some of the issues around data centers. And we have a meeting this afternoon to continue that and hope to have some specific language for you by the end of the week.
Okay. And on the LC?
The LC is LC 996. It's relating to the construction of facilities along public roads.
Okay. Senator Boquist?
We need to be in a work session.
So I'll open up a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 996, dated 9/19/14, be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Boquist moves LC 996 to be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And I will open a brief public hearing and work session simultaneously on Senate Bill 611 and Senate Bill 561. Paul, I think I got ahead of you here on anything that you want to update.
Mr. Chair, as I said, we continue to work on the issue developing language that would go into Senate Bill 611.
Okay. And we do have some people that would like to testify today on these bills.
It's 571, right?
No, 561.
I said 571.
You said 561, but...
Okay. All right. We're in a public hearing and work session on 611 and 571.
But no, the left and right ear still work.
We have Amazon and Microsoft represented here today.
Thank you, Chairman Haas and members of the committee. My name is Eileen Sullivan. I'm a senior public policy manager at Amazon based in Seattle. I want to thank you again for your sense of urgency in addressing central assessment. We so appreciate the efforts you've put into understanding this very complex issue and into addressing the myriad of concerns from many different stakeholders. We don't have specific comment on language because we don't have language yet, but I wanted to provide a little bit of context and detail today for you. In discussing this issue with legislators in Salem last week, we found there's some misunderstanding around our data centers in Eastern Oregon. So I'm here today to provide some background and details. Amazon Web Services has operated data centers in Oregon since the public launch of the region in 2011. Since then, we've created more than 100 full-time jobs in the region. These are skilled, well-paying jobs with compensation far in excess to the median pay in the area. Total job creation, including Amazon and contract employees, as well as construction workers, currently exceeds several hundred with an economic impact of more than $25 million per year in salaries alone. This is a result of building the newly completed 6 data centers in that region. With further investment, Amazon has the ability to do more than double its current footprint. Increased investment will lead to further job creation and economic development within the region. Furthermore, we're already among the top 10 taxpayers in the Oregon communities in which we operate, despite locating in enterprise zones with inherent tax abatement opportunities. Finally, as our business grows and matures, we expect our contributions to the region's economic activity and tax revenue to increase. We very much appreciate the direction you're headed with the language that we've seen most recently. We have some minor technical suggestions that we'd like to make today. We'll meet with staff later, though. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eileen. Mr. Gardner.
Jim Gardner, representing Microsoft. I should basically just say ditto. But I wanted to emphasize that there is a great deal of interest on the part of my company and its affiliated network of companies that produce Windows-based products in Oregon, growing interest. And suggestion that I would make as you go through toward a final version, which we agree with Amazon's very close to what you have now is very close, is that you keep in mind that the one thing you don't want to do is to discourage investment in manufacturing, in marketing, and in the kinds of things that are essentially retail, that are done by the same company but are separate from the transmission and data center business. Yep. And there's a lot of interest in those other activities as well in Oregon.
Questions for Apple, Microsoft, Senator Boquist?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
As Paul mentioned, those discussions are continuing, the work groups are meeting, and keep hope alive. I'm going to close the work session and public hearing on Senate Bill 611 and 571.
You want to carry them over?
And I will carry them over until tomorrow. And so let's move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 63.
Christine has some background.
Okay, we'll start with Christine.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Senate Bill 63 is an annual bill that is brought up as part of the connection to federal Internal Revenue Code and other tax law. And so it would update any connections in the Oregon statutes to the federal Internal Revenue Code. The largest change in the Federal Revenue Code has been the Tax Increase Prevention Act of 2014. This extended sunsets for provisions in federal tax from the end of 2013, December 31st, to the end of 2014. And so members of Oregon Society of CPAs are here today to go through the provisions of the measure and walk through changes that have been made at the federal level. Additionally, since the CPAs are available, it could be a good opportunity to ask questions about the pass-through rates from the grand bargain in Senate Bill 59. So if I know that measure was heard by this committee the other day, and so they would be available probably also to answer some of those questions because they understand these things better than others. And so the reconnect in Oregon statute, it's automatically connected to federal changes in tax law. So that does that connection and the choice to have that connection has a revenue impact. This is built into the economic forecast in the budget, and the changes from the Tax Increase Prevention Act are preliminarily estimated to be around $150 million in the first biennium. And so, but the this measure has the actually sets a connection for maybe a smaller group of federal laws, and the changes that have happened there are a lot more administrative in nature, and the revenue impact of the bill itself would actually be most likely minimal due to the things that it actually connects to in the measure. The measure just goes through, first changes references in ORS 238A that connect to federal law. This is the governing statute for the PERS program. And so the sections 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, as well as 7, refer to oftentimes minimum distribution requirements of federal law. And so this just updates the connection to that law to December 31st, 2014. Sections 8 refers to death benefits payable if a member of PERS of the individual account program dies prior to reaching retirement. It requires that the payments be distributed in accordance with that federal law and minimum distribution requirements. Section 9 refers to eligible employees who leave a qualifying position to perform uniform service, and it requires that the board take into account the federal law relating to benefits and service credit for any period of service in the uniform services for members of PERS. And so Section 10 refers to distributions of benefits, again, referencing the minimum distribution requirements in federal law. And so the PERS part ends in Section 10. And Section 11 really refers to shareholders of S corporations, and these corporations are defined in Section 1361 of the Internal Revenue Code. And that connection is updated to December 31st, 2014. And this really defines who can represent the corporation in a proceeding before the tax court or the Department of Revenue. And Section 12 also refers to the shareholders of S corporations and updates that connection to January 3rd, 2014, because there have been more recent changes. Sections 13, it has to do with the charitable tax checkoff, and ORS 305690 governs which organizations may qualify for consideration for the checkoff. Section 170 of the IRC defines charitable and government institutions that may receive a checkoff donation. And also different parts of the IRC define other entities that may receive these donations or be chosen for it. It defines child care organizations as well as Indian tribal governments. And these are all defined in federal law, and they're updated to December 31st, 2014. So then sections 14 and 15, 16, and 17 all update the connection for entire chapters. And those would be for corporate excise tax, income tax, tax credits, and corporate income tax. Section 18 updates statutes that give a tax credit to lending institutions that make a qualified loan certified by the Housing and Community Services Department. And that updates any references to federal law or the IRC to 2014. Section 19 modifies ORS 348-841 to update statutes on the Oregon College Savings Plan. It defines Internal Revenue Code as the code amended and in effect on December 31st, 2014. Section 20 deals with individual development accounts, and this is the definition of nonprofits under Section 501c3. And it's updated to reflect the latest reflection of that in federal law. So Section 21 modifies ORS 657-010, and this provides definitions for the entire Chapter 657 on unemployment insurance. And so all references in there are updated to December 31st, 2014. And finally, Section 22 modifies the IRC date for any citations in ORS 307-130. And this has to do with the property of art museums, volunteer fire departments, and the literary, benevolent, charitable, and scientific institutions, and reconnects to the latest December 31st, 2014 federal law for that. So additionally, if any the bill provides that if any of the changes retroactively result in additional charges for the taxpayer, that they wouldn't owe interest or penalties on those. And further, if they do receive a refund due to the retroactive changes, they could receive it without interest. And so in a nutshell, that's Senate Bill 63. There's an identical bill on the House side called House Bill 2102. And so they're completely identical in substance. But the Society of CPAs are here to discuss more in depth the changes. They have this document spiral bound here on the changes and outlines what had gone on in federal law for 2014.
Okay, so basically we have automatically reconnecting law, but needs to be updated in these places that Christine just mentioned. You mentioned the tax prevention, taxes could not be raised act. What was that called?
It was called the Tax Increase Prevention Act of 2014, and a lot of provisions sunset in 2013. And so what this mostly does is give them an extra year to be in effect. And there are things in here, primarily some of the the teacher tax deduction, where they could spend up to $250 on school supplies, and so things like that. That's been extended for another year, for example, so it would be an example of one of the many things that this this bill would change.
Taxes could not be Tax Prevention Act.
The Tax Increase Prevention Act of 2014.
Tax Increase Prevention Act, and if you see in your binder, you'll see on page 15, the Achieving a Better Life Experience Act. And if you wonder why our own legislative council here at the legislature discourages naming of bills, this is a pretty good reason why. So, for people who have been on the Revenue Committee for a long time, this is sort of one of the highlight days of a Revenue Committee when the CPAs come. So if you guys want to come up, I have Gary Sleep Powell and Robert. You want to just go through this with us, or you have an opening statement, or?
Chair Haas, I'm members of the committee. I'm Gary Holcomb. I'm a state and local tax executive director for Ernst & Young, representing the Oregon Society of CPAs.
And I'm Katie Powell, a CPA and now a shareholder of a local Portland accounting firm, here on behalf of the Oregon Society of CPAs.
And my name is Robert Karras, CPA, Clackamas, Oregon, on behalf of the Oregon Society of CPAs as well.
Okay.
So I'll give you a brief kind of outline of how we'll do it, and then we'll kind of each take sections since we have quite a few pages here, and we'll try to get through the relevant ones. More importantly, since there's so much, but just to kind of clarify, the Oregon Society of CPAs has testified numerous times, as you indicated, hoping to keep the Greek connection alive. It creates a lot of efficiencies for both taxpayers and CPAs and the people that prepare tax returns. The one thing to clarify, though, is that we say we're permanently connected, and we're only permanently connected to federal taxable income. And there are a number of other things that we're not connected to that impact the federal tax code. And that's, so if you look, there's a fixed date conforming, and a lot of the provisions that were mentioned have to be changed to that fixed date, which would be December 31st, 2014, and wouldn't be permanently reconnected. So that there is the difference between the rolling reconnect. And a lot of those types of changes are things for credits, taxable NOLs, penalties, those provisions that need to be changed where Oregon has similarities with the Internal Revenue Code. The two areas where Oregon is not connected have maintained this since 2011, which is the domestic production activities deduction, which is also known as Section 199, or the manufacturing deduction. So is what this allows a deduction for certain expenses that are conducted on domestic production. And there's also a permanent disconnect on the federal subsidies for prescription drugs. And Oregon has been disconnected from those for several years. But those are the only two that we're currently disconnected from. There's four sections that we'll each cover. Section A would fall under those items that are just general reconnect, where the legislature would not need to conduct anything further. They would just automatically reconnect. Section B are those items that we feel there's really no change necessary. It either relies on a penalty or some other Internal Revenue Code provision that wouldn't impact taxable income or directly on an Oregon issue. Section C is relatively short this year. It is things that we think the legislature does need to change in order to promote the promote permanent reconnection to the code. And then, even though we're accountants, we do know the alphabet, and we skipped D and went straight to E. And E is some provisions that don't necessarily impact the tax, determining the tax income, but they are in the tax code, and just trying to make you aware of some of the ramifications of those. So, I guess Ms. Powell will cover the first sections of A.
Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. It's my honor to go over some of the changes in Section A here. This first section includes federal tax law changes to which Oregon automatically reconnects, and those changes for which no Oregon modification is necessary to tie to the federal change. The first item on page 1 of Section A relates to the federal tax credit for qualified alternative fuel vehicle refueling property. Federal law provides that the basis in this property, such as for depreciation, is reduced by the amount of the federal tax credit. Oregon law provides for an automatic basis adjustment whenever the federal basis is reduced by the amount of a federal credit. Similarly, items 2 and 3 relate to clarification of the rules for the federal tax credit for certain electric vehicles. Again, Oregon law provides for an automatic basis adjustment when federal basis is reduced by a federal credit. And the last item on page 1 is the retroactive extension of the above-the-line deduction for teachers' out-of-pocket classroom-related expenses up to $250. And this has been in place for 11 years, and it has now been extended to apply through 2014. This is a deduction for federal taxable income, and Oregon automatically connects with respect to this deduction. Moving on to page 2.
Katie, can I ask you about electric vehicles?
Yes.
Where is someone then who buys an electric vehicle in Oregon? What's the tax incentive available there?
The tax incentive for an electric vehicle purchased in Oregon?
Well, the federal incentive is still in place, of course.
Yes, but
I believe that there is no Oregon incentive in any longer. I know that when I bought my Prius, there was a nice Oregon credit that was available to me, but that was 2007, and I think that's just simply expired.
It did, because we found there was a waiting line of people to buy those Priuses, and they didn't need an incentive.
Why incentivize them?
Yeah. But I just didn't know if we're connected. There's no, as far as I can say, there's no state connection at all, obviously, but I just wanted to, because it says double tax benefits. What does that mean?
I think the reference there is in regard to the basis adjustment for those vehicles, and because Oregon has an automatic provision where the basis is corrected to account for any federal tax credit that reduces the federal basis, there's no connection in that regard.
So, for instance, when you get your federal credit, your basis for the vehicle has been reduced by the amount of the credit. But on Oregon, you weren't allowed a credit. So on the Oregon return, the Oregon statute automatically boosts your basis back up to the amount you paid, so you can get a deduction for the full amount, since you did not, on the Oregon return, get a credit against your Oregon tax. So they're just trying to the purpose of that bill, of that provision, is just to maintain symmetry for the taxpayer, so make sure that the taxpayer is getting a fair deal with respect to depreciation, when on the federal return they get a credit as well as depreciation and a combination.
Got it. And that happens on a lot of credits that you get for federal purposes, where you don't get a deduction for federal, for example, the work opportunity tax credit, so that you don't get an expense deduction, but you don't get the credit in Oregon, so therefore Oregon allows you an expense deduction for that. So it keeps symmetry across all those types of credits.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Moving on to page 2, the code section 108 change involves the exclusion of home mortgage forgiveness from debt discharge income. Generally, forgiveness of a debt results in gross income, and discharge of a qualified principal residence indebtedness, however, is excluded from gross income, and the basis of the residence is reduced by the excluded debt discharge income. This provision has been extended through 2014. The next item on page 2 involves a clarification of rules related to an election available to Peace Corps employees and volunteers. These individuals may elect to suspend the 5-year ownership and use period for purposes of the home sale gain exclusion. The maximum suspension period is 10 years. The suspension is limited to one property at a time, and the suspension election may be revoked at any time. On page 3, the first item involves a change to the cafeteria plan key employee concentration test. This test now references qualified benefits rather than statutory non-taxable benefits. The income exclusion for a cafeteria plan for cafeteria plan benefits is not available for key employees if qualified benefits provided to key employees exceeds 25% of the qualified benefits provided to all employees. Also under the cafeteria plan rules, a special rule provides that a plan does not fail to be treated as a cafeteria plan, a health flexible spending arrangement, or now an accident or health plan merely because it provides for qualified reservist distributions for individuals called to active duty in the armed forces. Page 4 begins with the retroactive extension of parity for employer-provided mass transit benefits and parking benefits. The monthly exclusion limitation for employer-provided transit and van pooling benefits is the same as for employer-provided parking benefits through 2014. Another retroactive extension is the deduction for qualified mortgage insurance premiums, which are treated as deductible qualified residence interest through 2014. And at the bottom of page 4, we launch into the federal tax law changes affecting section 168. And these depreciation-related changes continue through page 9 of section 8 in your handout. The first of these involves the 3-year recovery period for racehorses, retroactively extended through 2014. On page 5, we have the retroactive extension of a 15-year maker's depreciation for certain building improvements and restaurant property. Qualified leasehold improvement property is also eligible for the 50% bonus depreciation in the year it is placed in service. Page 6 begins with the extension of the 7-year recovery period for motorsports entertainment complexes. Next, we have a change in the required minimum class life for qualified smart electric meters and electric grid systems from 10 to 16 years. And this is to maintain consistency with the minimum class life for property with a 10-year maker's recovery period. And last on page 6, we have the extension of depreciation tax breaks for Indian reservation property placed in service through 2014. The next page includes the extension of 50% first-year bonus depreciation for qualified property placed in service during 2014. In addition, the first-year depreciation limitation for cars that qualify for bonus depreciation is increased by $8,000 for qualified property placed in service during 2014. Page 8 begins with a corporate election to accelerate the otherwise deferred pre-2006 AMT credit in lieu of first-year bonus depreciation. And the next two items on page 8 and the first item on page 9 are clarifications and corrections related to this corporate election to trade bonus and accelerated depreciation for the present refund of certain deferred non-refundable credits. Second on page 9 is the retroactive extension of the special depreciation allowance for qualified second-generation biofuel plant property placed in service in 2014. And the last item related to Code Section 168 is a clarification regarding the prohibition of double bonus depreciation benefit for qualified reuse and recycling property. And with that, I will conclude my first segment and hand it over to my colleague.
I'm really heartened to see the federal government is taking care of racehorses and motorsports venues because,
you know. It's one of my favorites, yeah. Especially the motorsports complexes. I really appreciate that. Let's see. I'm starting off at the bottom of page 9 here, and there's just a lot of scattershot kind of things. which we're going to move quickly through, and I just want to call attention to a few things that I think are going to have some impact on the state's treasury. The first one at the bottom of page 9 is incentives for qualified conservation contributions. Qualified conservation contributions are donations of real property interest to a charity or to a state government for the purpose of protecting land areas, habitats, and historic structures, and that those incentives have been increased for an additional year. On the top of page 10 is a similar provision regarding qualified conservation contributions by corporate farmers and ranchers. Those taxpayers have slightly better benefits, I think, than individual taxpayers do. The next line item talks about above basis deduction rules for charitable contributions of food inventory. Certain contributions of food inventory by taxpayers result in a better deal for the donor because of the social good of giving away food to the right charitable recipient, and those enhanced deductions have been scheduled to expire in 2013, and now they're going to expire in 2014. The third item on page 10 relates to one of my favorite provisions in the tax law, code section 179 expensing, and this is something that just nearly every taxpayer uses, although not, at least in my practice, not every taxpayer uses to the full extent. Under previous law, the section 179 limitation for 2014 was going to be $25,000, which means that any property eligible for section 179 expensing would be available for a deduction, but not to the extent exceeded that the total purchase has exceeded $25,000 for the year. And that's a very low limit, but that limit's been in place since section 179 was enacted many, many years ago. During the Great Recession, the federal government saw it wise to stimulate the economy and increase that limitation to $500,000. And that $500,000 limitation has been extended for one more year to 2014. The next to the last item on page 10 is, I'm going to fill out the acronym for you, the Energy Efficient Commercial Buildings Deduction. And this is relating to the ability of a taxpayer to claim a special deduction for energy efficient commercial buildings. Capped at $1.80 per square foot and based on the cost of certain real property enhancements, energy efficient real property placed into the added to the building. The last item on the list deals with a section 179 election to expense the cost of qualified advanced mine safety equipment. That election to expense such equipment, which normally would be capitalized, that election has been extended for another year through 2014. At the top of page 11, a similar kind of incentive for qualified film and television productions. Producers of qualified television and film productions could expense 75% of the total compensation. Could expense the entire cost of those things, provided certain parameters were met. And that expensing election is now extended to qualified film and television productions commencing on or before December 31st of this year. So that means that after December 31st of 2014, i.e. right now, and we do see that. You know, we have Grimm, we have several other TV productions that are running on a regular schedule here in the state. Those costs would have to be capitalized and then recovered over the useful life or the economic life, if you will, of the television production.
Robert, can I stop? Yes, sir. Because we do have a lot of discussion about our own tax credits on film and video production. So what will this do in addition to those? How will this help Grimm and the other commercial makers?
Okay. Well, basically, this isn't the credit provision. This is simply the opportunity to deduct things. And the tax law requires that for any creative property that a taxpayer produces, that the cost of producing that property for certain taxpayers, not all taxpayers, but certainly television and film would be included. The cost of that production has to be capitalized, and then it can be recovered over, and I believe it's like an economic life of that property. So the taxpayer has to decide, you know, how many years is this property going to be economically viable? And if my esteemed colleagues would like to step in and correct me, because I'm saying something is completely wrong, I've been known to make mistakes. So so that is in a way a bit of a disincentive, right? Here I am going about making this beautiful video with monsters and police officers, and all of a sudden, instead of taking a tax deduction for the expenses of creating this artwork, I can't take a current tax deduction. I have to defer those deductions over the economic life of that property. Now, in the case of a television production, that might be a fairly short. In the case of a movie, Star Wars, who knows? And I don't know exactly what the rules are related to that, but I do know that those costs can't be deducted currently. So that's a disincentive, if you will. And that provision came into the tax law when I was still fairly new at this business. So it's been around for a while. This provision does is just says, you know what, we're going to give you guys a holiday. We'll just allow you to write all that stuff off. Forget about the rule to capitalize it under Section 263 or whatever I think it is. There's a special provision that applies to the costs associated with creative property. And we're just going to allow you to write it all off in the current year. That's not a credit provision. That's simply, just like Section 179, I'm buying a great big widget that I'm going to put in place in my factory. I can write the whole thing off in 1 year instead of depreciating it over the next 6 or 7 years. Same thing with this film and video production cost. As long as it's the right kind of film and video production, and as long as I meet certain standards regarding compensation and so forth, that I've created enough jobs, then therefore I can write all of this off. Now, I know Oregon has a credit program available for this, and it's in the form of a subsidy, and those credits are available for sale to people who would like to invest in those. This has no impact on any of that.
So this is accelerated depreciation, basically.
You said it so much more. I should have said it that way. Why didn't I say it that way?
And it comes into this sort of debate that we've had with Dr. Warner about whether we should be connected to accelerated our state depreciation kind of goes like this, and maybe it would be good policy, as Paul I think has talked about, is setting our own depreciation schedule long term. And anyway, that's what brought about that question, and maybe apply this to it, because maybe this isn't the best thing for us to do in Oregon for film and TV. Whatever pursuit we want, motor sport venues, you know, but particularly in those issues that we choose to sync up around our economy, whether it's films or semiconductors or nanotechnology or whatever. Anyway, thank you. Go ahead.
Certainly. And I would... excuse me?
Before you jump forward, since we raised you, I did have a question, just a date-specific question on when did... do you recall when the federal government... decided we were going to do 179 this last time? I remember 2 years ago, you remember they decided like on November 15th that we were going to do it, you know, 11 and a half months into the year. Do you know when the federal government did this last time? I'm not involved in it, so I don't know when they made that decision.
Senator, are you referring to, when you say do, you mean to renew the higher limitation?
Check.
I think that was whatever this Tax Increase Prevention Act was enacted.
It was late December.
The 27th.
So you did not know until December 27th of 14 that you could have done this back in January.
But we were worse than last year. We did it in the middle of November 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 3 years ago we actually did it. The federal government did it in January
of the year after.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And Senator, we are most likely going to be, according to the people who spend all their time in Washington D.C., we are most likely to be in that same situation again this year, where we won't know whether we have $500,000 or $25,000 to play with for our clients until December of 2015, and by that time, you've already bought all your equipment and you're just hoping that you're going to get lucky. Because I've got a client exactly in that situation, and that's what we hope. And I just tell them, look, put a lot of money in the bank, so make sure that if this bill doesn't pass, you can at least pay your taxes in April when you're going to need it.
Yeah. Too bad, Mr. Chair, we couldn't get lucky and elect some federal politicians to do this earlier.
Well, thank God they got the motorsports venue.
but
only for last year.
Yeah, those racehorses in Kentucky are pretty important. I think they've maybe trumped those motorcycles.
We're still up in the air for 2015 until probably the end of the year. Any other questions or comments?
Senator Bartziger.
So on 179, which I'm familiar with, and it's hard to plan. It's so difficult to plan. So the reset for today, snapshot in time, is $25,000.
Yes, sir. That is correct.
In 15, yeah.
For 15, yeah. Without any further ado, that's the rule we're stuck with, which goes all the way back. You know, I was afraid you were asking me when the original Section 179 was passed, and it had to be in the 1960s, when $25,000 was a pretty good amount of money. You know, that sounded like a lot back then, but it's walking around money now for most of us. I mean, I'm just saying, you know, you can drop $25,000 on just about anything you feel.
Sure. Not to my daughters. Study counting.
I would also make a recommendation they not say this on the House side either.
you could be stuck there for an hour and a half in that hearing when you said make that statement.
I'm just emulating our federal legislators who I believe said half a billion here, half a billion there pretty soon. Starts adding up. Okay, so at the middle of page 11, we have another item which might be of interest to the Oregon Treasury, which is Internal Revenue Code Section 222, and this is related to the qualified tuition deduction. The qualified tuition deduction is available through 2014. I did a little bit of background research because I was wondering what happened to those credits. There is also a federal credit for education, and those credits go on in one form or another, I believe, indefinitely. But the opportunity or the ability to deduct those in lieu of claiming a credit ends in 2014 unless this is extended further. The last item on page 11 is a technical correction regarding rules for property acquired in a non-recognition transaction, and I read it 14 times and I'm still not sure exactly what it's about. So if you don't mind, I just prefer to skip that one. It can't be a big deal. I'm just, you know, we're all human here. On the top of page 12, we're going to skip that one too because there again, this is a coordination provision with. Code Section 280F, depreciation rules for luxury automobiles and property acquired in a non-recognition transaction. Non-recognition transaction is a like-kind exchange. In the middle of page 12, there's a rule regarding the tax-free distributions of up to $100,000 out of IRAs. So this is something that a lot of upper-income taxpayers do like to take advantage of. They've got a lot of money in their IRA. They're subject to the required minimum distribution rules. They'd like to get rid of some of that extra money. They know they're not going to want to leave it all to their kids. They're going to give it away to charity anyway. And rather than pay tax to take it out of that IRA and give it away, the IRS, the federal tax statute, just allows them to bypass having to pay the tax in the first place and distribute that money directly to the IRA up to $100,000. That ability was scheduled to expire in 2013, and now our clients can do that through 2014. The benefit to the taxpayer is that without having to bring that $100,000 into gross income, you can avoid certain things that are certain taxes that trigger at high income levels and certain phase outs that trigger at high income levels, things like disallowed itemized deductions, things like the net investment income tax. The last two items at the bottom of page 12 are really about the same topic, and they regard multi-employer pension plans that are significantly underfunded and the ability of those multi-employer pension plans to adopt remedial methods of restoring adequate funding. At the top of page 13, there's a special provision for electric transmission companies. I used to say utilities, but they're not necessarily the same taxpayers anymore. And it's a gain deferral on qualifying electric transmission transactions. It allows electric transmission companies to sell their assets And rather than pay taxes on the full amount of the game in the year of the sale, the Internal Revenue Code allows the gain to be recognized ratably over an 8-year period of time. That 8-year deferral period was scheduled to expire in 2013, and now any sales occurring in 2014 are going to be eligible for that deferral as well. Not necessarily something that every taxpayer gets involved in, but when they do, I'm guessing it's big money involved. Next item, Code Section 460, talks about depreciation that's included in the percentage of completion the percentage of completion method. The next item, Section 512, talks about unrelated business taxable income paid by a controlled entity to a parent exempt organization. There's a technical correction regarding qualified disability trusts. Under Section 852, we start getting into regulated investment companies, RICs, basically regulated investment companies or mutual funds and real estate investment trusts. And they are these are technical adjustments to the way that regulated investment companies can avoid being penalized for not having distributed enough money. And that goes from Section 852 to 855. Under 897, we're hitting all kinds of exciting stuff here. I know we are. But bear with me. I think it gets better probably around the time that I stop talking. Code Section 897 talks about a special provision to that relates to the Foreign Investment in Real Property Tax Act, FIRPTA. Section 911 talks about the foreign earned income exclusion for taxpayers that that have a permanent assignment overseas or a permanent assignment outside of the United States and how they can exclude that income from their taxable income. The last line item affects subpart F, exceptions for active financing and insurance income. At the top of page 14, it's another thing regarding controlled foreign corporations. Look through treatment for payments between related CFCs. This treatment's extended. In the middle of page 14, we get back into regulated investment companies. We're going by Internal Revenue Code statute sections, so these kind of go all over the map in some ways because we're getting into that section of the Internal Revenue Code where there's just all kinds of things interspersed. Regulated investment companies making a single account election. Oh, this is actually kind of interesting. Basically, normally a taxpayer is required to identify the basis of stock on a first-in, first-out basis unless they can make an election to do things or want to make an election to do things differently. And this talks about how people who have stock in or who have shares in a mutual fund or who have shares held in a dividend reinvestment plan can make an election to average the basis of their stock and what happens to them when they make that election. A technical correction under 1016 talks about a basis adjustment rule for certain electric motor vehicle credits. And then at the bottom of page 14 is one that I've circled. It's a 100% gain exclusion for qualified small business stock. There's under certain circumstances, a shareholder who owns stock in a qualified small business corporation can exclude 100% of the gain on the sale of that stock. But you had to have bought that stock during a temporary period. That temporary period started on September 28th of 2010 and under the old statute ended on December 31st of 2013. And now stock that you buy, that one buys, a taxpayer buys in 2014 is also eligible to be treated. To be included in this beneficial treatment. In my own practice, I would be able to use this a lot, but I haven't really seen a lot of benefit for this, but I'm sure that there are taxpayers out there who take full advantage of this wonderful provision of the federal tax law. At the top of page 15, it talks about S corporations and their basis reduction for charitable contributions. Ordinarily, when an S corporation makes a charitable contribution of property, depreciable property. That property, It's the fair market value of that property that reduces their basis in the S corporation. And the reason why that's a problem is that anytime you have a basis reduction in an S corporation, then there's less ability for the shareholder to be able to deduct losses in the future. And this caps that, gives the shareholder a little bit more breathing room to deduct other losses by only requiring that the shareholder's basis is reduced by the basis of the property distributed or donated, not the fair market value. And that rule was going to expire in 2013, and now it's extended for another year to 2014. Code Section 1374 deals with the built-in gains tax on S corporations that distribute built-in gain property. The holding period had to be 10 years under the old law before the S corporation would pay a corporate tax to the IRS, and now the holding period is 5 years. But that 5-year holding period window ended in 2013. This is a rather slippery one. I confess that I have a hard time sometimes getting my brain cells around it. But that 5-year holding period ends now in 2014. So it's a benefit to the S corporation that it can dispose of built-in gains property. And this is significant for corporations that, let's say, have investments in real estate, for example. I had several taxpayers who faced this particular issue. And then the last one in my section here on page 15 is a technical correction to qualified empowerment zone assets. And again, it's an extender for these kinds of things. And with that, Gary Holcomb, my colleague Gary, is going to take over with the Achieving a Better Life Experience Act of 2014.
So there's a number of these sections. That the big one obviously was the extenders package that we've been through now, but there's a number of other ones that impacted, so we'll run through these pretty quickly. But in 2013, they enacted the Achieving a Better Life Experience Act, and those ABLE accounts are similar to like a medical savings account or a college tuition plan that allow certain certain items to go in there and then pay the expenses for certain disabled people. The first and the third item under that were basically some technical corrections to make sure that blinders or disabled people were able to take care of that. Also within the act, the section 529B, there was just to the 529 plan, there was a change that allowed the plan to make twice yearly investment changes instead of just once a year. The last one on that page, section 543, really has nothing to do with the ABLE Act, but it's for personal holding companies and whether certain dividends that those personal holding companies receive from CFCs are counted in income. And that really doesn't impact Oregon since we don't have a personal holding company tax. And 877, again, is just a technical correction that ABLE accounts are able to use certain rules called mark-to-market rules. Bob had mentioned several items that were similar to this 2014 Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act. Again, these are just funding mechanisms that allow certain changes to be made within these plans that are in economic trouble and aren't able to pay out the amounts right away. They can change some of the IRS rules without blowing the whole pension plan. The next one that we talked about is the 2015 Appropriations Act. And just allows defined benefit plans to change some of their what age requirements are, and this allows them to just change some funding of theirs. The next one is 833. Again, health organizations, certain ones are allowed to be treated as stock insurance companies. Not really that relevant in Oregon. On page 17, we have section 139, and within this, a number of Native American Indian tribes make welfare payments out to their members, and there's been a lot of interpretations within the IRS about whether those payments can qualify, if they're specifically for welfare, if, for example, they're just paid to every member of the tribe. And so there was a lot of interpretations about what that was, and this act was put in place to clarify that those payments made out by the Native American or Indian tribe are allowed to not be excluded from income. The last one, 17, is just again some more funding of pension plans and how pension plans should be done. Same with the first one on page 18. It's a cooperative small employer charity pension plan and how those should be defined. The Philippines Charitable Giving Assistance Act may be of some interest. Because the hurricanes happened late in the year, they said if you made a contribution in 14, that it allowed you to get a 2013 tax deduction instead of delaying that until 14. You only get it once, but they did allow it to be back. And that's the same as on the next page. It said, I think this is because of technology. It said, how do we know that you're giving charitable? Now you can text in donations and different things, and they're saying that that's proof enough, that if you can show a phone bill, that's proof enough to allow you a charitable contribution in that case. The last two are really small. Fallen firefighters, there was a 2012 incident in New York, apparently, and those payments are exempt. And then the last one is just changing the spousal IRAs to be called the K. Bailey Hutchinson spousal IRA. So that's it for section A, and we're going to move on to section B now.
I am pleased that our other members have returned, because this is such an exciting set of provisions that I promised to cover it in less than 5 minutes. I'm going to start the clock here. Let's see. Section B, really, as Gary mentioned earlier, these are mainly credit provisions that don't affect Oregon tax, administrative provisions and penalty provisions, compliance provisions, and also information reporting provisions, all of which are covered under separate statutes under Oregon law. So on the first page, page 20, we'll start off again with the Tax Increase Prevention Act. And the entire page relates to credit provisions, some of which are extended. Let's see if I have any that weren't extended. Yeah, they were all extended. Page 21. Most of these, all except for the second one, are all credit provisions. And again, they're all being extended. Things like the Indian Coal Production Credit and the Research Credit, the New Markets Tax Credit, the Railroad Track Maintenance Credit. You see what I'm saying? It's very exciting. Page 22, we have more credits based on the code section number there. We're looking at credits. And there's a little bit of a technical change, but most of these are extenders that just take the credit expiration out to 2014. Page 23, in the middle of the page is affixed to the alternative minimum tax, which Oregon does not have a corresponding tax scheme with. And the last thing is a qualifying energy product credit technical correction. Another technical correction at the top of page 24, and then under section 51, the work opportunity credit. Page 25 talks about the qualified zone academy bonds program, which is a type of qualified tax credit bond, which entitles the holder of the bond to a non-refundable tax credit. So basically, you get a federal tax credit in lieu of a better interest rate on these qualified zone academy bonds, but only a federal credit. Page 26 deals with a technical correction a technical correction to the way the alternative minimum tax exemption amounts are adjusted for inflation. I spent a good deal of time fascinated by why this was necessary. Page 27, the military housing allowance. Again, we're talking about a low-income housing credit, itemized deductions. Here's an interesting one. Page 27, in the middle of the page, the election to claim itemized deductions for state and local sales taxes. Because Oregon doesn't allow a deduction for state and local sales taxes, we didn't think that this really pertained to the Oregon law. Another technical correction regarding the state sales and excise tax paid on motor vehicles, page 27 at the bottom. At the top of page 28, a technical correction for in-plan Roth rollovers. Section 527 talks about the technical correction to the Federal Election Campaign Act of 1971. There's just a clerical correction. That thing has been in existence for so long they needed to clean up some changes that hadn't been corrected. Section 853 through the bottom of the page are tax credit bonds and regulated investment trusts and other kinds of credits and AMT. Just going to keep moving here, see if there's anything exciting that jumps out at me. And I don't recall that there was. Page 30. Oh, page 30 talks about information reporting by brokers. Earlier, I spoke about the average basis election. One of the concomitants or one of the implications of that average basis reporting is that it will allow more stock sales to be covered on the basis of those stock sales to be covered on the 1099, the broker issues. Under section 6213, there was an interesting thing to me, and that was regarding mathematical corrections. A mathematical correction by the IRS isn't the same thing as an audit. The scope of mathematical corrections allows the IRS to make changes that they would otherwise have to audit the taxpayer to make. And this statutory provision expands the scope of what is considered to be a mathematical correction so that the IRS can make adjustments for taxpayers who fail to include Social Security number information. At the bottom of page 30, talking about walking around money, the Joint Committee on Taxation of the Congress is required to review refunds to corporate taxpayers that exceed a certain threshold amount. And that threshold was formerly $2 million. When I first started out in this business, that threshold was $200,000. And now it's $5 million. Page 31, at the middle of the page, section 622 talks about penalties for failure to file information returns. Oregon has a statute which also enacts penalties for failure to file information returns. The federal penalty is $100 per failure to file, with a cap of $1.5 million if you have enough 1099s that you didn't send out, and that's only for oversights. If the failure was willful, the penalty is $250 per failure, with no limit at all on the total penalty. Oregon has its own rules regarding this. I thought it was of interest to the committee, perhaps to consider what the federal government is doing in this area. We have some, for the rest of the page, we have no tax code actually being altered for these things. The top of page 32, technical corrections, and then some statutory provisions coming in from the ABLE Act related to excise taxes and so forth. And then penalty provisions at the bottom of the page, going down up to the top of page 33. Let's just dispense with the rest of this. It's all excise taxes and so forth. We're sort of in the dustbin of the Internal Revenue Code. When you get to section 6722, you know you're really dealing with the rarefied stuff that only people that make arrows, bows and arrows, care about.
Okay. Thanks, Robert. very thorough. Appreciate your analysis. I think what interests me the most are the places where Oregon could disconnect from the federal law in places like putting out our own depreciation schedule or, you know, film and video production, for example. I think we did this infamously in 2003 when we disconnected from a thing called qualified credits, and Mr. Craven remembers this, and it was controversial at the time, but what we did was took the savings and put it into Oregon's R&D tax credit, which in the long term turned to be a much better deal for Oregon. I'd be very interested in finding some more opportunities like that, but one of the criticisms of doing that is frankly from accountants who say, oh, you're going to make things really confusing for our clients. Is that still the case, even with sophisticated software, or do we still have that kind of obstacle?
May I weigh in first on that one? Because I'm really passionate about this. Back in 1981, when I was very new at this, and when all these depreciation schedules were being done by hand, the fact that Oregon disconnected from the federal depreciation provisions was very, very difficult, to comply with. And numerous errors crept into clients' tax returns, not on mine, of course, but the numerous errors crept in because of the inability to simply deal consistently with all of that wealth of information. you rightly point out, Senator, that computer software has come a long way since then, and what used to require a mainframe now requires something about the size of this. Right. And we're more able to do that. But the one thing that is still the same, if you will, is the fact that sometimes taxpayers decide to change CPAs. And although we don't like to think about that, except in certain circumstances, we ordinarily, sometimes we fantasize about it, I'll admit. But most of the time, we don't like to think about that. But when that does happen, some of that legacy information does get lost. When a client comes to me and has four different depreciation schedules, I can almost guarantee you that with the amount of time that I have to deal with that between January and April 15, I'm going to be looking at the most important one, which is the federal regular income tax. And if I happen to slide on the alt-min tax, and if I happen to slide on the Oregon depreciation difference, I'm going to let it slide, which means that we now have an asymmetry, right? We originated a timing difference, what's called a temporary difference or a timing difference, originated back in whatever year it was, let's say 2015. And now here we are in 2017, and we have a new accountant, and all that legacy information is gone. And the detriment for having to pay more Oregon income tax in the first year of that depreciation schedule is not going to get fully recovered through enhanced deductions over the remaining life of that asset. Because all things that we're dealing with here with the film and video depreciation schedule, the motorsports, the racehorses, Section 179, all of that stuff is what's called a temporary difference. And temporary differences originate in 1 year and reverse out over the remaining life of that asset. So there can be impacts to a taxpayer even when computer schedules are being maintained. But it's a lot less onerous than it used to be.
I think the most recent example was when Oregon was disconnected from bonus depreciation in 2009 and 10.
Right.
So, you know, all that, as Bob mentioned, as a timing difference, the taxpayers most complied and added that back. So then they're allowed to the deduction into the current years. And you have to track those 2009 and 10 assets all the way through. And in my case, when I'm dealing with large multi-state corporations, they're tracking that for 50 different states. And trying to do it for every state correctly and every state being different can be very onerous. And, you know, it harms the state sometimes and it harms the taxpayer. It works both ways. Just from a pure mechanical perspective, as Bob mentioned, there's a materiality threshold to it all. So it's very difficult.
Okay. Having said that, is it beyond your bailiwick in the setting to say, here's one you should look at. This one is crazy. Anything pop up in your list? I have a list of a few, but you're probably stretching the boundaries of your
their lists are
analytical. Yeah. Okay.
We're always reluctant to say which straw it is that's going to break that camel's back.
Well, in a setting like this, outside of this, I'm always having tax people say, you guys really ought to look at this.
Yes,
so,
that's correct.
Well, we really appreciate you coming down here. I know this is your busy season, and going through this, and we'll take it back and go through it. And I do appreciate this. I'll hand this out on the floor today to for all legislators to give their tax preparers. And Senator Boquist, do you have any questions?
No, it's always
you
enthralling.
No, you do your own taxes in pencil.
No, I have a CPA that does mine, and so if he made the recommendation, I would be looking to replace him. So exactly like you said.
Okay. One thing we probably should check with you on is we passed in the grand bargain the small business tax changes, and I was just wondering if it's soon enough for you to have some analysis on how that's working, or any thoughts,
Senator? We had a conversation about whether we were going to talk about this and who was going to do it, and I think I draw the short straw. It's rather early for me personally. My colleague, Doug Henney, has been actually before the committee in a prior year, in a prior session, to talk about this. And I believe his depth of knowledge regarding this is probably greater than mine. But I would like to say that this is going to be a very, very challenging area. Personally, in my own practice, with the size of taxpayers that I have, and I don't, my colleagues here have much larger clients than I do. And my niche, if you will, my niche is what I would consider to be sort of a micro or atomistic type of a client. And my business clients, many of them are not going to be able to take advantage of this provision because they don't fall within the definition. Even if I were to say, you know what, you need to set up an S corporation, you need to take your LLC, your single member LLC, get your wife in there as a partner, set up an S corporation, get a flow through, get take advantage of this. If they don't have any employees other than themselves, it's still not going to work. So for the really small businesses that aren't considered to be employment generators, if you will, but yet at the same time bona fide additions to the Oregon economy, those clients aren't going to be able to, those taxpayers aren't going to be able to be affected by this. And so in my darkest thoughts, I kind of gnash my teeth a little bit and say, well, why aren't my clients going to be able to take advantage of this? Now, some of my clients will be able to take advantage of this. Most of them are already set up as S corporations and are already availing them, will be naturally sliding right in and taking advantage of this provision. It is a very complex one, but in another capacity with the state society, I've been meeting with the Department of Revenue, and their approach to how they're going to implement this provision is actually going to work very well in terms of making it easy for the taxpayer to comply, making it easy for the CPA to comply, and making it easier for the Department of Revenue to administer and to enforce. There could have been a lot of distracting difficulties about, and this is what Doug's testimony was about last year. There could have been a lot of distracting questions about, well, how do we deal with all of this complexity? Because the area that we're wading into here is a very, 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 very complex area of the federal tax law, which is the area of what constitutes a passive activity and what's a non-passive activity, because it's a switch. But that switch is, you can do things to flip that switch. You can do things that are counterintuitive and actually, in a way, counterproductive to flip that switch by grouping things together. So if you group things together in one way, you're trying to make them a passive activity because you need passive income. That's going to hurt you on your Oregon tax return because that passive income isn't going to be eligible for the lower rate. Okay, got a different taxpayer. This taxpayer doesn't want passive income. This taxpayer wants active deductions. So you regroup that taxpayer's activities in order to come up with an active loss. That taxpayer may also be disadvantaged under this particular provision because now they're not going to wind up with the benefit under the tax law that they might be entitled to. So there's a lot of complexity there. And rather than say, we can do it one way for Oregon and another way for the federal, which would just, what gray hair I have would actually start to fall out, okay, at that point. Rather than making me go through that exercise, they're just saying, well, whatever you do for the federal, you're going to do for state. So now I just have to think, where's the tail and where's the dog? If the dog is the federal, then either I get that state benefit or I don't, and I'm going to have to live with that. On the other hand, it could be a more complex dynamic, and I might have to look at the total picture and then think, and this is the thing which just drives me crazy, what's it going to look like 2 or 3 years down the road? What's it going to look like 5 years down the road? Am I going to regret this? Because when I make some of those grouping elections, I'm stuck with that for a while. So there's a lot of complexity here, and I think that basically for my clients, because we're just going to let the feds be the dog, and if we get lucky under the state, so be it. That's kind of the way I'm going to be dealing with this. Now, my colleagues may have a different... I certainly know that Doug Henney feels a lot differently about this. But I think that Doug Henney's got clients that have a lot more at stake. Doug's, you know, a large regional firm, downtown Portland, a lot of high-income taxpayers, a lot of large S corporations, and so forth. So, you know, they may have enough at stake where they will allow that small percentage break between the Oregon statutory rate and the beneficial passive or non-passive flow-through rate.
Well, those weren't the guys we were trying to help. necessarily.
Exactly.
So would you recommend fixing all of that or scrapping it and doing a more straightforward, simple, small business tax break, like, you know, raising the property tax level or something?
All I can say is my own personal preference is always keep it stupid. Keep it simple, stupid. You know, it's like, if I got that wrong, I admit. But I wasn't thinking stupid. I was thinking simple. And it's because I don't like making mistakes. It's because I don't like 2 years later opening up a tax return and going, you know, and when does that happen? You know, I'm not going to say every day, but, you know, it does happen. And the more complicated the tax law is, the harder it is to comply with it. The more complicated the tax law is, the more unpredictable its outcomes are, the more unpredictable the revenue that it generates is. I think, you know, don't let anybody tell you this. I know we're being recorded here, but you got to believe that a gross receipts tax is just the simplest kind. A sales tax is the simplest kind of tax to assess. How much did you make today? Send us a quarter of a percent. Now, I don't like those kinds of taxes because when you lose money, you still owe tax. Right up in Washington State, it doesn't make any difference. If you won or you lost that year, you're going to owe the state a quarter of 1% of their of what you took in. Is that fair? I don't know. I just don't know. Because, a property tax, we pay a property tax whether we have money in the bank or not. So, you know, sometimes taxes just aren't fair. But I like simple. That's my preference.
Senator Boquist, you were one of the grand.
Yeah, right. You opened Pandora's box, yeah, Mr. Sure. Chair, so we're going into this one.
I was going to try and avoid this based on the hearing yesterday afternoon.
As one of the authors of the grand bargain, go ahead.
I'm curious of you, same topic, but I'm curious of, you know, the impact, because benefit and break weren't topics that group had. We were trying to figure out how to come up with establishing enough equity. And at what level do you establish enough equity? Then can small businesses, these categories, borrow funds to expand? So let me ask you a pointed question, because you jumped into this. Is if your clients, which I understand are micro and smaller, they're in that lower category that I could give all kinds of reasons why we didn't get there, and I wasn't one of those going there. I was one of those that said, let's go there, and the others said, don't. But if, as example, yesterday in a hearing, it was said if we change this, the average small business that would be added would get $900 more a year back. Is $900 enough equity for your small businesses to go borrow funds to expand?
Now, when you say the $900 figure, is that the reduction in taxes that they would have for
check.
The year?
Exactly. That was in testimony yesterday in a different hearing.
So, in other words, is that $900 big enough to make a material difference to my clients that they would be able to do something new with that?
Right.
With all due respect, Senator, I don't believe so.
I mean, and that's the dilemma we had. So
Exactly.
And I don't know the number, because this, as you pointed out, there is no precedence for this. It's just the whole option we were trying to figure out is a mechanism in which we could, because small businesses are having a tough time borrowing money. Those big multinationals, they can walk in and buy prime. The Federal Reserve will just hand it over to the bank and hand it over to them. We saw this in QE1, QE2, QE3. But our local small businesses, even the ones size, I mean, how do you help those people go get capital? To expand and create jobs. And that's, I mean, so just for the record, Mr. Chair, I mean, it wasn't a discussion about benefit and who's getting a break. It was how do you create jobs? So.
Thank you.
There might be another way to accomplish that end other than tax policy. I would like to see something besides tax policy.
But you've got an idea. We're all ears here. We're into that.
I don't know. But no, I agree with you, Senator, because I see with envy how easy it is for the largest concerns to raise funds through debt, let's say, and how difficult it is for my clients to do the exact same thing, and how generously those larger companies can spend money, and how frugal my own clients need to be in order to make ends meet, in order just to pay the payroll, just to get to that bottom line. It's unbelievable the difference.
And just for record, Mr. Chair, I'm in the frugal camp. Okay, I'm not one of those big entities. So.
All right. We have a few minutes before we leave. I just wanted to get your thoughts quickly on tax reform in Oregon. We have a revenue income list that, when you match it up against the Swiss Alps, it seems to match pretty well. And I was just wondering if you have any thoughts on that. What kind of problems or issues you have with our system, with our income tax reliant system? And you've looked at multi-state clients and others, and and I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on our system versus something that's known as a commercial activity tax that's done in Ohio and other places. It's a corporate tax, but I'd like to pick your brain on that, Gary.
Yeah, it's hard for me to give an opinion because I'll have clients on both sides of every issue, right? Yeah. But in general, it's the consistency, I think, that the clients are looking for. You know, the multinationals they deal with, they're not, you know, looking to pay not pay their fair share or not comply with the law. They're all willing to comply with the law. It's the consistency and the ability to do it. And we saw it, like, in Michigan from 2008 to 2014, they went through four different tax regimes. And now they're back to more, you know, they still have a sales tax, obviously, because we're only one of five states that don't. But they went through four different tax regimes. They had a gross receipts tax. They started with one that was two tax. They had a gross receipts and an income. Then they went to only gross receipts, and now they're back to only income. And it's that inconsistency between all of them that makes it very difficult for our clients to comply. So, you know, the tax policy choice and the revenue raisers, those I can't really speak to. But I can speak to just complying, and they're all able to comply, to your point about software and different technologies and use of advisors like myself, right? They're all able to comply. Just tell them what you want.
Senator Virtue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, I always threaten to bring in my grandparents' tax returns from the 40s or 50s and say, we went from this to this. I mean, it was one page, one side, a few lines, but so I like the simple. But for somebody that does run a business and a corporation, my biggest challenge is planning, because we start planning the year at the beginning of the year, and if the rules change, it is such a struggle to plan. You just never know where you're at, and we fight that year after year with this, you know. Section 179 is a prime example.
Mm-hmm.
Do we not? You know.
Can we afford this equipment or not?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Or do we just bank the money and figure that the taxes are going to be higher? And if we have, then we've missed an opportunity, because we could have borrowed a little bit of money at a low interest rate at the early part of the year, and bought that thing, and maybe added a few jobs or whatever.
Absolutely.
And exactly the conundrum that my largest client has year over year over year over year. Do I spend the money on equipment or not? Or do I hold it aside for taxes? Now, the tax rate's not 100% of the amount that I'd spend on the equipment, and I try and remind him of that, because I think he thinks that the tax rate's 100%. It only feels like it to him.
Yeah. Right.
But in terms of simplicity, one of the things that my clients have asked me, several of them, what do you think? Should I relocate to Washington State? Because they don't have an income tax up there, right? So why don't I move to Washington? And when I run the numbers just on income taxes, B&O, and even the property tax, when I just look at those three forms of tax, they're always better off here in Oregon than they are moving up to Washington State, interestingly enough. And it's because of that gross receipts tax. It's just like that half of a percent off the top can be a very expensive chunk of change. Plus, you're paying sales tax on all your fixed asset equipments. And if you're in the business of buying a lot of fixed assets, like one of my clients is, that can be a big ticket item too. And there's no holiday for that unless there's a special, like an R&D kind of a business or something like if you're in Intel.
You're talking about your business clients who ask about moving to Washington.
Yes, exactly.
The
right.
Individuals.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. The business clients. The individuals, they have different situations. But we're talking about people with, you know, gross receipts, payroll, net income, and tax, and the tax then that flows through to them from their S corporation. So yeah, which is it better? And of course, you don't want to incorporate your business in Washington and live in Oregon. That's like the ultimate in bad planning. you're going to have to bite the bullet, and you're going to have to move to Richland, you know. I mean, it's Ridgefield, I mean.
This film is going to be part of my repertoire from now on, this film of you.
Yeah. You're off again. Well, thank you again.
Yeah.
We'll be in touch. Thank you for our guide, your handout today. And really do appreciate you coming down here in your busy season.
Well, we're grateful for the opportunity. Society, thanks you very much.
Okay, committee, thank you. We're carrying over our central assessment bills, 611 and 571, tomorrow. We have the economic revenue forecast on Thursday. No further business before us, so we will adjourn.